Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 247 for Monday, April 25th, 2016. Bill Atkinson, part two. Triangulation is brought to you by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/triangulation. And by PillPack, a full-service online pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit PillPack.com/TWiT to save $20 on vitamins and over-the-counter medications when you transfer your prescriptions. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hey, everybody, it's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology. And today, the guy. You may have seen part one of our interview a couple of weeks ago with Bill Atkinson. Bill, of course, was the guy at Apple on the original Macintosh team. He did the QuickDraw primitives that made the Mac sing. He wrote Mac Paint, then wrote HyperCard, which really transformed the world and in many ways was the inspiration for the World Wide Web. He went on to found General Magic, which was an amazing company, really an incubator. Andy Rubin started his career there before he invented Android. Of course, Andy Hertzfeld joined him at General Magic from the original Macintosh team. Just an amazing guy. And, you know, Bill was so generous with his time. He came up. He brought a lot of show and tell. He brought pictures. He brought his book. And, I mean, he was just incredible. And ended up giving us 3 hours. 3 hours. So we knew that really would be too long for a single episode, so we've divided it up. So you're going to see now part two. If you haven't seen part one, it's kind of in chronological order, so go back and watch part one of our interview with Bill Atkinson. But today, I'm really pleased we can bring you part two of our conversation with Bill Atkinson.
I want to talk about General Magic. You brought the General Magic with you.
Well, you asked me to.
This is the most important, I think, after Apple, one of the most important events in Silicon Valley was these great minds like yours going, and didn't Andy went with you, didn't he?
Andy Hertzfeld, Mark Barat, and
Mark
I
Barat.
Were the co-founders. And we brought some of the best minds at Apple, in spite of Apple's crumbling, and other great minds that we knew from other places.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends came there.
Yeah.
And it was kind of an incubator. I think we failed at our main task of what we
ironically,
wanted to do.
Yeah.
But we brought a team of people together that ended up doing wonderful things in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Like we became sort of like, I don't know, the training wheels for people that went on to do wonderful things.
Andy Rubin
invented
Android.
And Tony Fadell.
Oh, Tony Fadell,
the iPod and the iPhone.
Yeah.
I go through a roster of general magicians, and many of them have contributed a lot to.
But you were early. You were probably before your time, right? This is the General Magic device.
Well,
first, show me the inspiration.
This is the prototype. So this is actually a 8mm video cassette tape. Anybody remember that format?
Yeah, right? I still
Nobody
have a few that I have
anymore,
to convert.
But,
yeah.
And the idea was a kind of a cross between a digital camera and a pager. That you could take a picture and flip it over and write a little something and send it off into the internet.
Oh, how interesting.
And a telecard would drop into your daughter's pocket. And she'd pick it up. Oh, I got a telecard from Dad. Now, remember, this is before texting. There was no text messaging. Okay? And this is before the internet.
And before photo cards.
There was no web.
Yeah.
There was no web browsers.
And there was no digital cell infrastructure.
Yeah, way before a photo card. Photo card was 20 years later. Right. So, and what we tried to do... John, we brought together a team of consumer electronic giants, 20 major guys, Panasonic, Philips. This is Mark Perrat's genius, was we can't reproduce the Sony Betamax versus VHS fiasco, right, where customers ended up stuck with a technology, yeah, that was incompatible with what they could, yeah, rent at the video rental store.
Right.
So we wanted all these guys to play together. Like you buy a compact disc with music on it.
Works
we used to do that. But
right,
you buy a compact disc with music, it'd work on anybody's, right, player, whether it's, right, from Toshiba or from Panasonic or...
Standards. Yes. Yeah.
So Mark got together all these giants and said, come and work with us. We will ensure a interoperability that you could make a telecard transceiver, a magic cap device, that would send cards... And it didn't matter which brand you had to receive them.
So really, General Magic was doing the software, and you,
yes,
hoped to have a platform that others would build the hardware for.
Well, we did a reference platform of hardware.
Right.
That
which
we
you have,
the
I
design
think.
For which we, yeah, then gave to Philips and Sony.
Right.
Did
they follow along? Did they follow
they
up?
They made their... Well, so, for example, this is the Sony Magic Link. Maybe it's a little bit bigger than this.
Well, as it turned out, it had to be, right?
Well, here was the problem, I think. So we, yeah, really failed for three different reasons.
Yeah.
One is that the hardware was too expensive,
yeah,
and not subsidized.
Right.
You know, when you buy an iPhone today and it's, you know, it's free, being free with a two-year contract...
Right.
Really, it's not free. Really, it's a $400 iPhone.
Right.
Well, these things weren't subsidized by a contract.
The carriers, yeah.
And the cost of materials to build one of these was much more than it cost to build an iPhone these days.
Really?
We had things weren't the same kind of scale that,
right,
we are today.
It was
so
a touch,
that's the first is this thing came out like, I think, $750.
Wow.
And worked its way down toward
$300. Yeah.
But it needed to be $50.
Yeah.
So that each member of a family would have one.
Right.
You know, when you buy walkie-talkies, you don't buy one.
Right.
You know, nobody's got a walkie. You buy a walkie and a talkie. And we wanted each member of a family to have one.
Right.
Now, the problem was, with that expense, people felt it had to be more than just a telecard transceiver.
Right.
Right? It had to do more to be worth that. And what John Warnock, who was on our board, said, he says, you have a beautiful idea here, a fresh idea of the telecard. It's a new way of communicating with other people.
Right.
Entertain me with a picture on the front and,
right,
and put a message on the back,
right,
and keep it short and sweet so,
yeah,
I don't get inundated like an email. But when you take PIM functions, you know, all your
calendar,
meeting organizers
contacts,
and calendars,
yeah,
and you know, all the different functions you add around it, what you end up with, instead of a rose, you end up with a bouquet. And, yeah, there's a rose in the middle, but people won't even see the rose. And so that's one of the things that happened. The second is the infrastructure wasn't there. Digital cellular had not been deployed. So like the Sony unit had an RJ11 jack. You had to go plug it into a phone jack to send and receive. You could queue up things to be sent and received, but they didn't actually get sent or received till you plugged it in. Now, the Motorola one did better than that. It had a radio in it. But it used this ancient Artist system that was like 1,200 baud and expensive.
Artists. I remember Artists. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were ahead of our time that way. The other way we were ahead of our time, the third way, is we had the best and brightest of all these big consumer electronic giants. And then in 1993, the internet happened. Mosaic came out. And people started seeing this is where things are going. And so our partners, rightly so, said, well, this thing with its small black and white screen, that's not a web browser. Let's pull our best guys back to go work on the web. And they did, and that was the right thing for them to do. But it also meant that a big exodus of people working on the General Magic thing.
They called it Bill and Wired Magazine called it Bill and Andy's Excellent Adventure. but it
was wonderful working with Andy.
It must have been. Oh, Andy's another wonderful.
We shared a cubicle.
Warm, sweet guy. As
I love
well.
Him.
Yeah, yeah,
I love him, and he's smart, and he's got a great heart.
Yeah,
you know he.
Isn't that interesting that you know, so many people with great hearts, great vision, great minds, but. A lot of times great minds don't go with great hearts, but so many of you in the Macintosh group had that spirit. And I guess you have to credit Steve for putting that team together.
Well, you know, he said make a dent in the world, and
yeah,
he meant in a good way.
Right.
You know, make a difference. Make your life count by making other people's lives better.
And it was more than
what I did at Apple was making tools to empower creative people.
Right.
You could summarize everything I did at Apple,
right,
as tools to empower creativity.
Right.
And there's a huge leverage in that Like, I would see HyperCard stacks that people would make that were beautiful and wonderful, and they were done because the person, let's say, there was one about a music stack teaching Beethoven,
yes,
using a audio disc in the player, but they could step to different portions,
right,
of it quickly.
Right.
And it was made by a music teacher who wasn't a programmer.
Yeah.
And I always thought that it would give better results to give programming abilities to people with a passion about something than to take programmers and
exactly
try to instill,
right,
a passion. So
exactly
this guy's,
right,
lifelong passion with music,
exactly,
could suddenly,
right,
be expressed because he had a new creative tool, a creative outlet to express that.
My father's a paleontologist. He used to teach Darwin at UCSC, made a stack of Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle. He's not a programmer, but he was able to make this beautiful stack with images and everything. So how did HyperCard come about? This is after the Macintosh, of,
yeah,
course. Did somebody say to you, we need this, or did you just
say,
this is what I want to do?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there was a fallow period when I was kind of depressed and hunting,
sure,
around for the next thing to do.
Yeah, what's next?
You know, one way of thinking about it is, Steve had said, come and follow me, I'll make you fishers of men. You know, it was Steve, you know, Jesus Jobs.
Yeah.
We were looking for the second coming of
the
Jesus
apostles,
Jobs.
The apostles.
And it wasn't happening.
Needed a gig.
You know, what do you do to follow that act?
No, okay? So had he been fired by this at this point, or what was he doing at this point?
At the beginning of HyperCard, I think he was still there.
He was still there.
But at the end, it wasn't.
Yeah.
In fact, when he left to form Next, he asked me to come with him.
He wanted you to go.
He said, you got to come with me.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm in the middle of this HyperCard thing. I think it's going to be important. I want to follow through and do it. He said, well, you could do it at Next. I said, well, you know, Apple will distribute it to millions of people. They are my publisher. And I love you, Steve, but I can't. I want to do this. And he said, well, if you were really my friend, you'd come with me. Oh, that backed me into a corner. If you were really my friend, you'd want me to be fulfilled and successful,
right,
at what I'm doing, and you would be rooting for me, and you would be advising me, you should stay with Apple because they can get this out to many more people than we can.
Did you say that to him?
I did. And so we had a period of about a year that we didn't really talk to each other that much. We had been really good friends before then. There was a period of, maybe two and a half years where we ate more dinners together than not.
Yeah.
And I, you know, if you'd asked either of us who their best friend was, it'd be the other.
You must have hated that movie.
I did. Each of the movies about Jobs was terrible.
Yeah.
The one
I hated him, and I didn't even. I mean,
the Aaron Sorkin one.
Yeah.
Was just totally
horrible.
not truthful at
that
all.
Wasn't the guy.
That wasn't his character, and the events didn't happen. You think of Jobs having a reality distortion field. I think of Aaron Sorkin as having, or at least that movie, as having a history distortion field.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of people will experience that
sad.
And think that's the way it was. It wasn't that way at all.
Well, let's
the
correct
only thing
the
he
record.
Got right in that movie was Joanna Hoffman. The portrayal of Joanna Hoffman was spot on.
Interesting.
Even her accent was right. But her character and her way that she was trying to rein in Steve and keep him from pissing all over himself,
right,
you know, keep him from making an ass of himself, that was Joanna. And I recognized her in that movie. I didn't recognize the Steve at all. That wasn't Steve.
There was no heart in that character. I think Steve had a lot of heart.
And even the factual events were either out of sequence or never happened.
Never happened.
For example, having Woz say, you should give credit to the Apple II guys, at each of these three events, he wasn't at the second and third event at all. So
that did the injustice to Woz, too.
I don't think
they
did. You know, the best accounting of Jobs is actually the book Unbecoming Steve
I love
Jobs.
That one.
Brent Slender and another writer.
Tetzley, yeah.
And they did a really good job of showing kind of the arc of Steve's career.
Yeah.
It's true, at the beginning, he was very polarized. It was gods and shits. And if you were currently interpreted as a god, you knew that you made stupid decisions like anybody else. You were going to fall off your pedestal when they found out that you farted and shit and made stupid engineering choices yourself.
Right.
And, you know, if you were head, then no matter how beautiful
exist.
Work you did, you would, you know, feel like you couldn't get elevated.
Yeah.
So, but that's just the beginning.
He was a young
and
guy.
He grew and he mm-hmm. learned how to work with his people, to develop them. I think working at Next did a lot to educate him, to bring him up into working with a team. Certainly having a family made a big difference
No mention of that in the movie at all. And
I think the Brent Slender book is a more honest portrayal of the arc of his career. And everybody likes to just focus in on this a caricature of his first years.
Right.
Like, you know, a character, they exaggerate. He didn't really look like that, but if he had a big nose, well, they make it even bigger.
Right.
That's what they did. And I think it's a really disservice to what actually happened. And it's a disservice certainly to Steve's family, because they know what he was really like.
Yeah.
The reason he wanted Isaacson to write the book and why he gave him carte blanche to, you know, there's no skeletons in my closet, you can turn over anything you want, was he wanted his children to know why he had been so busy working at Apple that he hadn't had a lot of time to play with them.
Did you spend some time with him towards the end?
I did. Yeah.
And you had patched up those differences a long time ago.
Yeah, a few years after we split up, we both had kids at the same school. We were at Crystal Springs High School, and there was a music event where the kids were singing, and we happened to sit next to each other. And at a break, he turned to me and he said, "You know, HyperCard was really ahead of his time, wasn't it?" Mm. And that was the first time he'd ever said anything good about HyperCard. I think before that, the problem is, HyperCard is the reason I didn't go to Next, and it had Scully stink all over it.
Right.
You know, it was
doubly damned.
Right.
Yeah.
And for him to say that, I thought was really big, and kind of the first time he actually said it was an apology as far as he could go.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're
it meant
looking
something to me. I went home just.
I bet it did.
Just touched.
Yeah. You're looking for something to do. The Macintosh is done. Did you have more to do at that point, or? I'm sorry. I shouldn't have brought
that. So
back
I was
Steve's
an Apple fellow. They'd given me the highest position that you can without having to be a manager. I didn't want to be a manager. I want to be a tech. So equivalent to a vice president in stature and compensation. I received good compensation, but being an engineer, I wanted to stay an engineer and build things.
Yeah.
And for a while, I worked on a project that I called. I think I thought of it as a learning processor. You know how a word processor works? It doesn't tell you what to write. It just facilitates the process of writing.
Yeah.
I thought, how would you facilitate learning? So I went around to a lot of schools, and I watched, and everywhere I went, I asked them, where are best examples of learning? The Open Magnet School down in Los Angeles, the Nueva School for Center for Learning in Hillsboro, and I went to a lot of places and sort of spent some time there watching the learning process and talking to teachers and talking to students. And I even did some sort of substitute teaching myself. I taught a photography class.
Neat.
And in order to try to research what would facilitate learning, if you can make a learning processor that didn't tell you what to learn, but facilitated the process of it. And what I found was that actually doing things for real was an important part of learning. That when you isolate it and say, well, this isn't for real, this is an exercise for learning, that's exactly what makes it useless and boring and belongs to the school and doesn't belong to me. When you do something real, and what I found are the tools for access, which became Google in the long run, the tools for access to information and motivation that teachers gave, often a really good, you know, there'd be, you talk to somebody and they'd say, one teacher made a huge difference in my life. How? What happened? Well, they were passionate about a subject. They had a personal enough relationship with me that I modeled that passion, and I went on beyond what they ever did. So they were into Fibonacci numbers, and I did all kinds of artwork around Nautilus shells and things like that. And it's really about instilling motivation or providing access to existing motivation. Mm. If a kid is excited about cars, get them out to the assembly plant in Fremont and let them watch electrostatic, you know, paint application and welding and robotics. Right. And, you know, the kid may end up being a roboticist.
Right.
But he was because he was interested in cars.
Right.
Because the teacher took the time and effort to give him access to follow that passion. And so what I wanted to do was make a learning processor. And what I concluded after maybe a full year of research was that the tools for access and the tools the ability to motivate people were really where it was at, that if you made something that was just for learning, it was guaranteed to be a failure. You're like, this is an exercise that belongs to the school.
Yeah, it's synthetic.
Yes. So doing real things was really an important part of learning. You learn because there's something you want to do.
Right.
I've often thought that this push for, oh, everybody should become a coder,
right,
is really misled.
Yeah.
What you should do is think in terms of what is it you want to change in the world?
Right.
What kind of object or software could bring about such a change?
Right.
What tools would you need in order to be able to build that software or object?
Right.
And then go learn those tools.
Right.
So if you're doing something in the web, maybe you should learn Python.
Right.
If you're learning doing something on iOS, you should learn Objective-C or Swift.
Right.
If you're learning doing something for, so each tool, you don't learn a tool because you want to learn the tool.
Right.
It's like if you want to learn Chinese, it really helps if you have a trip to China planned.
Yes.
Right? Because you've got a reason to learn it.
Right.
And I think that this notion of, let's teach everybody coding is working backwards.
Yeah, I agree.
You start with, what is it you want to do?
Perfect.
What is the change you want to bring about in society?
Yeah.
How can you have an impact on that?
Right.
What can you build that will help the world in that way? And then work backward to the tools.
Right.
I remember in Apple II days, this one guy was wanted me to coach him on managing his farm. He's a rancher and he had cattle, and he was thinking he had to have a computer to manage his cattle. And I spent a little time with him and I asked him questions. I went around with him a little bit, and I came back with a 3-ring binder that had one page for each head of cattle. And it could keep track of when the vaccinations were and what the weight was and what
it's complicated.
And I said, this will go in your saddlebag.
Right.
And it has a user interface that you don't have to learn. Here's their pencil, And
he thought you were going to write a program.
And so I think you have to start with the goal rather than starting with a technology that you're trying to push on people.
Yep.
That's backwards. If you have a technology you're trying to sell, then you're a salesman.
Yeah.
If you're trying to assist somebody in doing something, then you have to work from their point of view. And I think it's like that, the programming stuff. Now, I ended up giving up on the learning processor. And the way I came on to HyperCard, was really in terms of thinking about islands of information that are disparate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 65. I can tell things that I wouldn't told if I were earlier. HyperCard was inspired by an LSD trip that I took on a park bench outside my house in Los Gatos. And I had taken some really nice acid, and I was, sitting up the whole night watching the stars, and I'd look up there at the stars, and I kind of looked down, and, there were street lamps.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a parallel between the stars and the street lamps. The stars are these globs of thermonuclear energy burning, and another one over there, but they're so far apart.
Mm.
Many of them can't even communicate. It's speed of light limitations. There's sort of, if these guys were talking to each other, they wouldn't have much of a conversation. And as I looked down at the street lamps, and I saw pools of light and another pool of light and sort of a dark area in the street, I thought about human knowledge.
Mm.
I thought about how the physicists know some things, and the poets know some things, and the musicians know some things, and the chemists know, and the biologists know some things, and there's a lot of paraphrasing between them, but they don't talk to each other, so they don't see the bigger picture of how they connect. And I thought, and I also saw the curvature of the planet, which is probably because I was wearing thick glasses before my LASIK. But I saw that I was at the apex. I was standing on the top of this sphere.
Right.
Well, of course, we all are.
No matter where you are.
Because that's a sphere, and the pull of gravity pulls down.
Yeah.
And I realized that each of us are leaders of the Blue Marble team.
It's like the top of our spaceship Blue Marble.
We're all on the same team together. Yeah. We're all breathing the same air. We're all leaders. Yeah. Each of us has to assume a leadership role, and we do what we can. And I thought about how if you were a soccer team captain, you'd want your team to play well. It doesn't matter that your team isn't the best soccer team. It's just you want to play better than you were able to before.
Right.
And so you look for the weak link. You say, okay, the goalie's letting too many through.
Right.
and you spend hours with the goalie after. And that dedicated extra time with the goalie helps the whole team to prosper. And I said, okay, I'm one of the captains of the Blue Marble team. What does our team need? And what is weak on is wisdom. We have technology to change the future, but not the right wisdom to make the ethical and aesthetic choices about between alternative futures. We need more wisdom. I thought, well, hell, I'm a kid. I don't know. I'm not wise. I'm not old enough to have wisdom. But in this sort of acid haze, I thought about the relationship between information and knowledge. You have to have information before you can have knowledge. And knowledge is kind of the how connections. How does this connect to that? How does this work between information? But I saw another level is wisdom is kind of the why connections between the knowledge. If you have modules of knowledge and now you want to make ethical and aesthetic choices about different futures, that's really a why question. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if you could at least facilitate this, the connection of the different bodies of knowledge talking to each other, then there's kind of a trickle-up effect that you might develop some wisdom on the planet. And so that's where HyperCard really came from. Yeah. I thought about how can we get the scientists to talk to the musicians and how can we facilitate that communication. Now, I just come from a world where we pasted a tennis shoe into a MacWrite document, and now the world dealt with words and pictures.
Right.
And I thought really what you want is more also is interaction. Yeah. You want to express something in a way that someone can interact with what you've made.
And
the
how
interactive
did you implement
document.
That?
So I said, let's make a stack of cards. And each card can have graphics on it, mm-hmm. and text on it, and buttons that you can touch, and they'll do something. They'll go to another card, or right. another card in another stack, or right. and they'll make a video disc go to a certain frame. And there needed to be some flexibility about what the buttons did. And what I wanted to make is essentially a software construction kit.
Yeah.
That allowed non-programmers right. to put together prefab modules, kind of drag and drop a field here and a button here. And they didn't have to worry about saving the field out to the disk and all that. Now, I take care of that. There were high-level things. There were, automatically retained information. Mm-hmm. You put something into a field, it's there. And if you unplug the computer, it's still there. In fact, that was one of my goals. I didn't like the way you had to save documents.
Yeah, right.
So my deal was if you have done something and you unplug the computer from the wall, it has to have everything you've done up to within a few seconds.
That's great.
So it always was trickling stuff out.
There was no save in HyperCard, was there?
No, there wasn't need.
Wow.
It was always trickling out to the to the disk. Now, there was a revert. You could go back to a prior version, but basically having to save a document was a mistake.
I think Tim Berners-Lee has said that the hyperlinking within HyperCard was kind of part of the inspiration of the World Wide Web.
Yes, it was. Mosaic came out 6 years after HyperCard, mm-hmm. and although it didn't copy any of the code, I think Mark Andreessen wrote me a sweet little note saying thank you for the inspiration.
Absolutely.
Just so the ideas. So the web was, instead of a stack of cards, it was just
pages.
And pages had graphics on it and text on it and buttons that could take you to someplace else.
I feel we've lost something, though, by having lost HyperCard. What happened? Why don't we still have HyperCard?
Several things. First of all, when Jobs came back to Apple, he had to pare down what they were doing.
Right.
They had
too many
projects, and he had to draw this little diagram of,
consumer
work
and business,
and lap portable and desktop, and we're going to do those four projects.
Four quadrants, yeah.
And so that's one of the things that happened, and so they had to kind of cut projects. And, of course, HyperCard had Scully's mark on it, so it was one of the things that went.
Mm-hmm.
I think other things happened too. HyperCard, so I cut a deal with the devil, which is, as I started with this idea, I thought, this has to be cross-platform. This can't be Apple only. And so I can't work at Apple when I'm doing it. And so even as an Apple fellow, I said, you know, I want to go work on my own now. And I'll write some great software for the Mac.
Right.
You guys will benefit. That's
right.
not a problem.
Right.
And they said, oh, you got to stick around here where everybody's, you know, they look up to you, admire
right.
you, you
right.
know. And so I worked, I cut a deal, which is I'll write this and I won't take any money from Apple while I'm writing it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. And when I'm done with it, I'll give you a right of first refusal. You can choose whether to accept it or not. And if you didn't, that's fine, but then it belongs to me.
Right.
I had had an experience with Don Denman writing a beautiful Mac BASIC that had local variables, it had indentation, it had... It was
I
really,
used it.
And he got
it
screwed.
He got screwed
because
Microsoft,
Apple
right?
had to... Yeah, Microsoft
yeah.
did not want that competition,
yep.
and they put the screws to Apple. If you ship that, we will not renew the
that
Apple
That was the rumor,
Apple
and I
BASIC.
Always wanted to ask you about that.
The
so
Apple
it's true.
II, Apple Soft BASIC.
Yep.
They would not
it was a
renew
tit for
it.
Tat. Yep.
And so Apple had to. Don Denman came to me and says, help, they've screwed me. And I went to Steve Jobs, and he said, it's too late. We already signed all the contracts. And I learned from that.
You know
that
what,
I don't
out.
Want to write something
right.
and have it squashed.
And then
now, there was
you
some
have
pressure
no access.
To squash HyperCard.
Really?
Apple was really afraid of pissing off developers. Right. Apple needed developers. They were all
right.
jumping ship to go to Windows or I guess... Windows back then, and they didn't want to, you know, freak out guys like FileMaker or something
right.
like that. And so what I did is I arranged for a right of first acceptance. I said, I won't take any money while I'm doing it.
Yeah.
If you accept it, we'll accept it at an agreed upon price, which was fair. And Apple made out very well because when they put it to Claris, they made... much more than that.
Right.
But if you don't want it, then it's mine to peddle.
Right.
Now, the devil's part of the bargain was, if they did accept it, they owned it lock, stock, and barrel, source, and everything, and I didn't have the right to commission a team to make a Windows version of it.
Right.
So partly why HyperCard failed is it was Mac only.
Right.
We're going to get back to more of our interview with Bill Atkinson, my hero, in just a little bit, but first, a word from Texture. I love magazines. I don't want magazines to die. I want to keep them alive, but what I don't want is the clutter on my coffee table, and I don't want the expense of subscribing to a magazine or buying a newsstand issue for just one article. The problem is that there's so many magazines that every month there is one article I want to read. The New Yorker or Rolling Stone or Esquire or Vanity Fair. There's always, every month, one article I want to read. I want to always see the pictures in National Geographic and like to catch up a little bit on the gossip and people and us and Entertainment Weekly. Well, now I can do all of that for one flat fee. It's kind of Netflix for magazines. It's called Texture, and you're going to love it. Texture has most of the best magazines in one place. You can read them on your iPhone, your tablet, your Android device. The full magazine, everything you'd get on the newsstand issue, and previous issues too, plus bonus features you can't put in print, like video and stuff like that. So this is a great way to read magazines without all that clutter, without all that cost. It's very affordable. They've completely reinvented the magazine reading experience. With Texture, you get the magazines you know and love, plus exclusive features and videos from magazines like, well, Men's Health and Wired and Interview. And I can just go on and on. The most popular magazines anytime, anywhere. Great for the airplane. You favorite the magazines you want. They automatically download each week. You, even if you're off air, off the internet, you can still read those magazines. And I like it because they have a top stories and new and newsworthy section, so I discover new magazines and articles and magazines I didn't know about. That's updated daily in the Texture app. They also make it easy to find articles you care about. They have an editorial team that lets you deep dive into interviews and stories of interest to you across a bunch of magazines. And, of course, when you star your favorite magazines, that instantly adds them to your personal library so you can read them every week, every month. Look, you got to try it. We got a free offer for you. Go to texture.com/triangulation. Get your free trial. You'll get immediate access to all the top magazines. That includes back issues and the bonus video content. Texture, T-E-X-T, let's get it, text, texture, T-E-X-T-U-R-E.com/triangulation. Now let's get back to more with Bill Atkinson. You know, I ran a Mac bulletin board in the mid-'80s, and somebody had leaked to us Mac Basic because we knew that Apple was never going to release it. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous
product. Don
Genman
did really good work.
And so we put it on the bulletin board, and people downloaded it because I just wanted people to see it, you know, and got away with it, thank goodness. But that was a tragedy. And HyperCard is a tragedy in some way. So Apple had it. They had the rights.
Do you know where HyperCard is now? Really? In iBook Author.
Yeah.
In iBook's Author, you can drag and drop pre-made modules that play videos, pre-made modules
that
do a stack of JPEGs.
Right.
It's really an authoring environment for the non-programmer to drag and drop and, just replace stack of cards with book of pages.
Right.
And you got the same, but it's
right.
much more powerful.
Yeah.
And it's color and it's has animations. And it's really, that's where HyperCard has gone.
I guess you're right, yeah.
That is the descendant of HyperCard that is modern.
There are people trying to do
beautifully.
Do
and,
other HyperCards.
And it has something in it that the HyperCard never really had, was a publishing arm.
Right.
You write something in iBooks Author and you say publish, it's in the iTunes store.
Yeah.
Whereas HyperCard stacks, people had to put them on a sharing site, and there were a lot of shareware.
Yes.
People were sharing them.
Oh, yes.
And it was open source. I was open source before open source was cool. You could open any button up and see
and
inside
see the
on mouse
code.
Up Go Card 3.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
At least
or the
see
HyperTalk
how
card.
It worked
so
that you could modify it for your own use. And a lot of people made HyperCard stacks by starting with somebody else's and modifying it.
Did it kind of give rise to AppleScript? Because they're very...
Yes.
HyperTalk and AppleScript
are very similar. AppleScript is a descendant of HyperTalk,
but
taken a level back so it can be system-wide.
Right.
I use AppleScript a lot in some of my production stuff. It can use Photoshop as a subroutine, and it can use, go back and forth between Excel and Photoshop and text programs and InDesign. When I was doing my book, I used Apple scripts to lay out pages and go relay out them when necessary as things changed.
Yeah.
So Apple script is a descendant, and I think an improved descendant over HyperTalk, because it's a system-wide thing. I use Apple script to control my spray bot that I'll tell you about later.
We want to see some video of that. We'll take a break. I want to talk about your photography.
Yeah.
Bill, you've done so many things in your life, and you're taking such joy in what you're doing, and I just love it, and there's so many things I want to talk to you about. But we should talk about your current projects, which are Photo Card and your photography. You're a wonderful photographer. It sounds like you were doing that all along.
Yes.
So
I started my photography when I was 10 years old.
Oh, neat.
My mom gave me a subscription to Arizona Highways magazine.
Yeah.
And I saw these glowing aspens backlit by Joseph Munch, who's like David's father and Mark's grandfather. So Mark Munch is a current generation of that family. But I saw Joseph Munch's pictures, and I cut them out, and I made a little sort of paper mat, and I put them on my wall as a 10-year-old, and I noticed that I got something from them. I looked at those, and I got some kind of nourishment. And I told myself, when I grew up, I want to make pictures that inspire and nourish people. I started doing nature photography, and at first I could only do black and white, because I want to print it myself. I don't want to send it off some lab,
Right.
I want the control and to make it really beautiful, I needed to do it myself. And so I set up a little darkroom down in the first it was just down in the basement, and I had to wait till it was night to even do it. And it was dusty down there. That was always a problem.
Kid.
Right. Yeah, I was a 10-year-old.
You had a darkroom.
Yeah. And I went around taking nature photos. But I did learn pretty quickly that color was important to me. I think you can do really beautiful dunescapes and figure studies of nudes in black and white. I think they're
it's
better
about geometry,
in black and white,
because
they take away some of the distracting details. But taking a picture of a flower or a rainforest or some of the stuff
or
I'm doing now with polished rocks,
it
is all about the color.
Yeah.
And so when I was in high school, I took a job as a color portrait printer for Arthur Mintz Photography in Los Gatos.
No kidding.
And on the weekdays, I would print portraits. But on Sunday, the darkroom was mine. And they liked it because I kept the chemicals fresh so that on Monday they wouldn't have a sludge. On Sunday, I could come in and take my nature photos and print them.
Fun.
And my mom was very encouraging. She literally would, she was a busy woman. She was an OBGYN, mm-hmm. but she would drive me over to Boulder Creek before I had a driver's license.
Wow.
And sit there knitting and reading. And she had this Freon air horn left over from the, we used to go to the Seals hockey games.
Yeah.
She could blow that horn if her beeper went and she needed to go do a C-section. Actually never ended up blowing the horn, but that's what it sounded like. And she did that because she thought this was an important part of my spirituality. Since I was a young child, I was an atheist. I said, I don't see any evidence for this mumbo-jumbo stuff with the God that listens to all my thoughts and judges me. And, you know, this is, show me evidence. And she kept trying to convince me. And no, I didn't buy it. But so I wasn't religious, but I was spiritual. This
sure.
is an important part of my connecting
nature
into the world and
sure.
feeling part of, there's something really beautiful happening mm-hmm. that we get to be part of.
Mm.
And I want to partake in that. So she would do that. And she commissioned me to make 4 big prints for her waiting room as a doctor, symbolizing earth, air, fire, and water. And
what a great commission.
Yeah. And I love.
Do you still have those images?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. I have the images. I don't have the 4 big prints.
No, the prints.
Yeah.
But you do have the pictures.
Yeah,
good.
I do.
Yeah.
So my nature photography was always a matter of personal sustenance.
Interesting.
And I did it. When I went to undergraduate school, I set up a darkroom. When I did it, when I get to graduate school, I remember when I moved out of married student housing at University Washington in Seattle, I had to kind of explain why the chrome plating on the sink stopper was all gone, and it was just yellow now from the bare copper. But I always used it as a personal expression.
Yeah.
I did it at a professional level, but I didn't sell. I gave the prints to people.
Wow.
And when I went to Apple, again, I had a darkroom. And what I would find is it was really a good way. You're in the middle of a programming problem, and programming requires some intense focus and discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like juggling 10
yeah,
balls.
Yeah, you have all in your head.
And you drop
yeah.
one, it's going to be a bug.
Yeah.
And it's going to take you a long time to find and fix that.
Right.
Much more so than if you just didn't drop it, right? A lazy person's approach to programming is don't make bugs. Right? And I found that when I was up against trying to design something, I couldn't quite get it. If I went and souped the prints in the Dektal in the dark room and watched this image appear, you know, under the safe light, it took me out of my programming mind and into a more tactile and physical space and allowed a different part of my brain to do the work.
Yeah.
And I would come up with brilliant solutions when I wasn't thinking about things.
Right.
It's because I had steeped myself in a problem.
Yeah.
And then I did something different.
Wow.
So I always did that. And I gave people my prints. I loved
nice.
That. I did find there was a problem. When I went to color, in black and white, I can make a beautiful print and I can manage the tonality.
Right.
There's always a range of contrast in the scene, and
right.
the paper doesn't have anywhere near that. The paper's
right.
never going to glow like that light there.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you have to manage the range of tones, and that's what the zone system was all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I could do that well in black and white and dodging and burning and things. But when I went to make a color print, at first I used Ilfachrome process with slides, and mm-hmm. you can never get the colors right. You could get one color right, but the others would be really wrong.
Right.
If you got the grass right, the sky was going to be
right.
wrong.
Right.
And I couldn't really, this was really frustrating. And also, I have a visual impairment. I am partially red, green, what they call colorblind, which is totally a misnomer. I have a deficient red, green vision. I can tell red from green,
right.
but I can't tell it as well as most people can.
Right.
Like for you, there are various shades of green.
Right.
Some greens are more yellow like avocado,
yeah.
and some greens are more blue like Hunter, right?
Yeah.
But they're all greens, right?
Yeah.
Well, for me, red, brown, and green are in the same family, and they're more reddish browns and they're more greenish browns. So I can tell them apart,
right.
but it's harder for me than most people.
Yeah.
So if I just dial the numbers on the enlarger trying to get the right color, I'm not going to be happy, and I might make something that's really just not right.
Other people might say, what's that?
So what happened is I ended up becoming a color guru. I bought expensive spectrophotometers. I learned how to get the color right by making what we call ICC profiles to define the relationship between the numbers we're working on in a digital image and the colors we're going to get on that printer.
Right.
So you print out big charts with lots of patches and measure them with an expensive machine. Now you make this lookup table, allows you to get exactly the right color. And what I could do then is give exact color.
Right.
Not approximate color,
right.
Not seat of the pants color.
Not by your eye.
And because of that, I ended up training over 400 photographers in color management, scanning, and in Photoshop.
Interesting.
And, you know, whatever I learn, I want to share with other people. And I called up some of my heroes, like Pat O'Hara and Franz Lanning and Galen Rowell, and said, you want to learn how to make a really good print of your work? Come and live with me for 2 weeks. I'll teach you. And I didn't charge them anything. And just... I empowered them, and part of what made me a color expert was my own limitations of my own visual perceptual system.
Interesting.
And it sort of, you know, reminds me of like Beethoven
composing
over his deafness.
Yeah, interesting.
That in fact, if I had really good color vision, I might not have become a color management expert.
Well, Galen Rowell definitely learned because his beautiful nature prints, just gorgeous. Must have been in some.
He had some interesting experiences. People would come and buy a print of his,
yeah.
and it'd be a beautiful print.
Yeah.
But they say, "Oh no, I want it like in the book." And he'd say, "No. Here's the original transparency.
This is
the correct thing. I sent a stack of transparencies to Hong Kong, and that's the way the book came back."
Yeah.
And when I later went to do a book,
you got to go to China.
I realized you have to have the correct color in the book.
Yeah.
Or else they'll expect that.
Yeah.
And so I did some innovation on that.
Somebody gave me a copy of your book. I'm very excited. We'll show that and talk about that in just a bit. And I wanted to mention the Steve Jobs quote. I think it's from the Walter Isaacson book, saying, "Taking LSD was one of the most important things in my life." Jobs said himself, "It shows you there's another side of the coin, and you can't remember it when it wears off, but you know it." And it's kind of a similar experience, isn't it?
I wouldn't say that strongly. I'd say under LSD, I could remove some of the visual perceptual filters.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the things I've seen under LSD, I can still see now if I look for them.
Right.
Like the trails past my hand.
Yep.
They're still there.
Yep.
It's just normally we filter them out.
Right.
Right. Also, I found the thing that I liked best about LSD was its ability to... dissociate identity.
Right.
There's
ego.
There's no self.
Yeah.
The ego dissolves, and there's no difference between me and that rock for a while.
Right.
But what's beautiful is as you're coming down, you actually get to fabricate that distinction.
Right.
It's not a separation, but it's a distinction. What do I choose to honor as being Bill,
mm-hmm.
and what
mm-hmm.
do I choose to honor as not Bill?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you see all these little events in your life floating down in little parachutes.
Right.
Now, I didn't see this literally, but emotionally, I felt that. And I would see, this is the Bill that did this. And I noticed that was something, an interesting event that happened in my life, but it wasn't me.
Right.
And another thing, this is the Bill, had this child or did this thing or loves that person.
Right.
Those things I could take inside. And it was kind of a sort of a refining process.
Interesting.
You find the core of your values. And for me, I like to take acid about every 5 years. It's not something I want to do all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a sacrament. And it's
a
something
sacrament.
I do alone.
Yeah.
And I do with the expectation that I'm going to learn something.
Right.
And after I've done that and gotten really clear who I am, what I'm about, what are my core values, why am I on this planet, then I need some time to go and produce, to go and do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a contemplative mode. That is an active mode. It's kind of like, I remember the old Help movie where every so often this swimmer surfaces and says, "White Cliffs of Dover?" And somebody points that way. And he turns the direction a little and goes that way.
This is you surfacing, getting your bearings,
getting bearings.
Back. Yeah.
So that's I never liked doing acid like at concerts or things
that.
Or
it's
in
not a
social
recreational
environment. To
drug.
Me,
yeah.
it was a sacrament that helped me to get clear about what my core values were.
It's very interesting. Are you still an atheist?
HyperCard? Yes.
So, but this is a spirituality for you.
Well, I think something much bigger than this notion of a supernatural
that's
God that
petty,
reads your thoughts
and
is jealous about other gods. That's just got to be really something. Got to be wrong. There's something much bigger happening.
Yeah, there is a spirituality.
Consciousness is blossoming to colonize the universe.
Yeah.
On this planet, there used to be no consciousness.
Right.
It used to be so hot there couldn't be nucleic acids or proteins.
Right.
There was no life. And at some time later, there was life. And sometime later, there was complex life that could even contemplate themselves. And even, you know, we have an awareness that is pretty darn special. And you think about what's so important. You know, if you step on a roach, you don't think that much about it because they're not that self-aware and that conscious. You step on a cat, that's a different thing. You step on a human baby, that's really bad.
Yeah.
Okay? Their value is because they're so magical that they could have come to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's so improbable that, I mean, I don't know how to create a cat. You know, I don't know how to create a human baby other than, you know, the usual way. But I think that we're involved in a process that's much bigger than humans, and that process is going to colonize the universe with consciousness. And we're a step along the way, and we get to be part of it. We're not the end-all, be-all. I don't think, you know, evolution isn't done. And thinking of ourselves as, you know, the end-all, be-all evolution is kind of like thinking about the world as being flat or at least, you know, all the planets revolving around the world. There are so many galaxies out there and so many stars in each galaxy. The odds that we're alone are very slim. But also, the odds that we communicate with each other are really slim, unless wormholes are real. Because of the great distances. So we all have to live in a way that we do our best for this corner of the universe. But the universe will be colonized by consciousness at the speed of light, and that means it's not going to be matter that travels. It's going to be information that travels. And a beautiful thing about information is you can share it without lessening it at all. I can share knowledge with you, and I haven't lessened mine. If I share pie with you, I got to have half as much myself.
Right.
Information is a lot better thing to share, and it can move at the speed of light. So I'm spiritual. I don't believe in organized religion. I actually am pretty negative about it. I think it's done a lot of damage. And I think it's like believing in Santa Claus. I remember having this sort of question about, well, when do you tell your child that there really isn't a Santa Claus?
You
know, my sister was a Sunday school teacher, and she said these two kids that were talking about Sunday school afterwards and saying, well, what is this stuff about the devil, Satan? Is that real or is that make-believe? And the other one said, oh, it's probably just like Santa Claus. Really, it's my dad. So I am an atheist, but I'm a spiritual atheist.
Yeah.
I believe we're involved in something really magical, and we have an opportunity to participate and actively shape the choice, the destination of evolution. It's no longer a random process. It's now directed evolution.
Fascinating.
We get to choose the futures, and that gives us a big responsibility.
So glad you're enjoying our interview. We had so much time. Bill was so generous with his time. He gave me 3 hours, so we decided to divide it up into 2 interviews. This is the second half of that 3-hour interview, and we're going to have more with Bill in just a little bit. But first, a thank you to our sponsor, PillPack. This is a new technology disrupting the pharmacy space. It is an online pharmacy. Well, that's not new. You say, oh, but wait till you see what happens. You sign up with PillPack, you transfer your prescriptions over, and then you automatically get the PillPack box. And inside the box, the little pill pack pouches. So you never have to wonder whether you've taken your medication, what medication to take. The box is packed with automatic image recognition technology to make sure exactly the right pills are in each pack. They can even detect dispensing accuracy by size and shape. If you look at your box, you'll see on the back is a picture of each medication or a vitamin or over-the-counter drug that you take, the description of it, the dosing information, the prescription information, So you know exactly. So you can see what you're supposed to take. And then there's the pack. And, boy, it's great. It's got the day, the date, the time. So you know exactly when to take it. It's all in there. Easy to open. I really like that. And you know what? This is great if you travel, because you can just tear off the packs you're going to need, throw them in your travel kit, and now you've got them. And you know exactly what to take and when. There's never any mystery. Did I take my pills? Did I forget? Did I take too many? No, you don't have to worry about it. Best part, this doesn't cost you a penny. Shipping is free. The service is free. You just pay your regular copay. They accept most forms of insurance. They'll, of course, check, make sure that it's covered, including Medicare Part D. Time Magazine called it one of their top 25 inventions of the year. Jill Duffy gave it her editor's choice in PC Magazine. I agree. I mean, this is awesome. Visit pillpack.com/twit. You can sign up now. It takes 5 minutes to get started. They'll take care of everything for you. And when you use that link, pillpack.com/twit, and transfer your prescriptions over, you'll get a credit for $20 worth of vitamins and OTCs. pillpack.com/TWIT. We thank them so much for making triangulation possible. Now on we go, talking with the legend himself, Bill Atkinson.
We're talking with Bill Atkinson. He created Quick Draw. The Quick Draw routines in the Macintosh and Lisa Rom were instrumental to almost everything that followed. He, of course, wrote Mac Paint, kind of eating your own dog food, as they would say these days, using Quick Draw to create a beautiful bitmap drawing program, HyperCard, General Magic, which he founded with Andy Hertzfeld.
And Mark Perret.
And Mark. Let's not forget Mark. And a great photographer. I have, and a thank you for this. I'm so thrilled. Is this the newest book that you've done here? It's called Within the Stone.
It's the only book I've done.
The only book?
Yeah, it came out in 2004.
You got to do more of these.
Yeah.
This is beautiful.
I thought about doing a Beyond the Stone, but it's really hard getting a book of photographs published these days.
Is it?
Yeah. The publishers lose money.
Yeah.
There's so many really great photos out on the web that people don't buy books.
Yeah, people don't buy them. But you would want these because these are gorgeous. And these look abstract. They look like paintings. But these are cross-sections of stone.
Yeah.
What is that, lapis? Oh, calcite.
Yeah.
Blue calcite. Just gorgeous. How do you choose? Look at that. How do you choose these? How do you shoot them?
So you can flip to the back to see a page on how I shoot them.
All right.
Open source guys, so here's all I've
I love
everything
it that you
I've
share everything. Isn't that awesome? Have I gone too far?
Not quite that far. There'll be a page on my macro setup and a page on how I printed this.
Yeah, because it's
a little beautifully
there printed book. There we go. So, look at that. Wow. What kind of camera are you using to shoot this?
So what I use now is a Phase 1 IQ-180.
How many megapixels is that?
80 megapixels.
Wow.
Medium format.
So beautiful camera.
16-bit, really good pixels. I learned a lot about photographing these. I started out, I was photographing the landscape in Arizona. I was photographing in Page, Arizona, where there are slot canyons, kind of the rain gullies for the mountains.
Yeah.
And when you get a rain warning, you don't want to be in a slot canyon. Lots of people have died that way.
Yikes.
So my friend Charlie and I went over to the eastern part of Arizona to the Petrified Forest. And what I saw, I got down into a riverbed there, and there were cracked pieces of petrified wood that had been polished by the silt flowing over them. And there was a beautiful range of colors and gradations.
How gorgeous.
And the petrified wood in Arizona is probably the most colorful anywhere in the world of the petrified woods. But I got fascinated with it, and I thought, you know, the colors on the inside of the rocks, it's kind of brown on the outside, but let's see about the insides. So I went around to all the local rock shops, and I bought pieces of petrified wood that had been sliced with a diamond saw. It sort of slowly grinds through with a diamond grid and oil to keep it from getting too hot.
Right.
And then polished on a flat lap into a vibrating pan and coarse, medium, fine, extra fine grits. It takes a week to polish it. And it basically is like grinding a lens.
Right.
You end up with a glass smooth surface.
Wow.
Well, I saw these pieces that had already been cut and polished. I thought, oh, they're gorgeous. I want to learn how to photograph them. So I took them back. I bought a few thousand dollars worth of rocks, and I brought them back home. And first thing I did was put them on a high-quality flatbed scanner, and the results were terrible. And what I learned is you can do much better by photographing them using cross-polarized lighting. So this is where the lights lighting
it
have polarizing filters on them, and then another polarizing filter on the camera. Now, this isn't something I invented. It's a standard technique that photographers use for copy work and things like that. One way you can think about that is that light is electricity playing leapfrog with magnetism at 90 degrees.
Okay.
So as the electricity dies down, it generates magnetism. The magnetism dies down, it generates electricity. And that's what makes all electromagnetic radiation, from radio waves to cosmic waves to light, to light is a little skinny section of that. But that's what light is. It's electricity and magnetism playing leapfrog. Now, if you make a filter that has a whole lot of little conductive molecules, they make it in a plastic and they stretch it as it's drying so that all the long chain polymers get oriented.
Uh-huh.
Now it's like a picket fence.
Yeah.
That the light of different orientations will get shorted out unless it's aligned to that.
Yeah.
So it'll only let through those rays that are oriented in a certain way.
That's what a polarizing filter
does. That's what a polarizing filter does. Now, when you shine that on the rock, when it comes back as a glare from the surface, it's still polarized. But if it comes back as a diffuse reflection from the innards of the rock, it loses its polarization. It kind of gets randomized. And so now if you put a filter on the camera, you can dial in the filter. You can rotate that polarizing filter to selectively cut glare or enhance glare. You can actually see down into the rock.
So these
like
are
a fisherman would see into water without the polarizing.
This looks like it's backlit, so it's not backlit.
No. These are all... See the picture there? They're all frontlit.
Because it's glowing, but that's what the effect is.
Well, you just want to cut the glare so you can see the real colors.
Yeah.
Now, it's actually a little bit the opposite of that when you're doing something like a tiger eye or an opal, where the glare is the color.
Right.
If you take all the glare out of a tiger eye, it won't look gold.
It's boring.
It'll look yellow.
Yeah.
You take all the glare out of an opal, it won't. Won't shine.
Look at this tiger eye. This is so beautiful. These are gorgeous. By the way, you do prints of these. In fact, you brought this one as a print, I think.
Yeah.
So if people want to buy prints,
I brought a bunch of prints, but I wanted...
Can they go to BillAtkinson.com and get prints there?
Yeah.
Because these are just stunning.
I bought a flat lap and a diamond saw, and I learned to do it myself.
You make them.
And a half a dozen of the ones in there are ones I ground and cut and polished myself.
Nice.
What I found was a lot more efficient was to go to the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show the first 2 weeks of February every year and get pieces that are already cut and polished. And I would sift through stacks of these and choose ones to photograph. All day long, I would borrow pieces.
Oh.
And then I
photographed
them all
down.
Night. I brought the whole table there and set it up in a friend's house. And then I would photograph them all night long and I'd bring them back the next day. And what I did is each year, those that I got good ones of, I'd bring back a big print.
Oh,
and so I got very popular there.
Yes, I bet.
And I remember the range of rocks that I got to photograph is way beyond what's in any one person's collection.
Of course.
These are the mineral dealers, the rock hounds. They're really passionate about what they do. We'd sit around and eat dinner, and I'm eating dinner with somebody from Russia and somebody from Australia and somebody from Madagascar, and we're all talking rocks and drinking a beer, you know?
Yeah.
And they trusted me. And were generous enough to let me photograph the rocks. There's a picture in here of a black opal from Lightning Ridge, Australia. And that's a $50,000 rock.
Wow.
And I kind of mustered all the chutzpah I could put together and asked this guy that I didn't know.
Can I borrow
Paul
your
Sedowy
rock?
Paul Sedowy of Seta Opals. I asked him, could I borrow this to
wow.
photograph it? And he said, oh, you must be that Atkinson guy that's working on the book. Our friends Philip and Denise Stone said you were trustworthy.
Oh, neat.
Now, how long would you need it for? Oh, like 4 hours? And he took me in the back and fit me out with a belly pouch under my shirt so nobody would know I had this
Oh, my thing. Goodness.
And you know, he didn't even take my driver's license down.
Wow.
He trusted me. And that level of trust and generosity, that's the one, actually. That is
But look at the result of that. It's incredible.
What
you know who's
going
to love this? My wife is a huge fan of stones in general. We have a lot of polished rocks in our house, ton of them. And she loves opal, and she's going to really appreciate this.
Do you know what makes opal have its color?
No.
There's a little bit of water in it, and there are a whole lot of little balls of silica about the same diameter that line up in the water and become a regular grid and make a diffraction grating.
Oh.
So the light coming in fans out into a rainbow, and as you turn
you'll see
different colors.
Yeah.
And if you take an opal and you put it in a 500-degree Fahrenheit oven for an hour, it won't shine anymore.
Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Especially with
keep
this.
Keep your ovals from getting too hot. And that's one of the things I had to be very careful when photographing this, is make sure that I didn't get too much hot light on the subjects.
Chat room says you're a rock star.
Oh, yeah.
In more ways than one. In more ways than one.
So I found the rocks to be a subset of landscape photography at a smaller scale, and one that's been less explored than the larger scales.
It's hard. So, I've talked to many photographers say it's hard to do new work, do something new. Everybody has a camera now. Everybody's taking images, and so it's hard to find a unique image. But you have found this is.
I'm surprised not more people have followed on. I published this book in 2004, and I left clear instructions in it. Here's what I've learned
how
to photograph these.
Yeah.
Anybody wants to follow in my footsteps, here's how to do it. I think I set the bar a little bit high. That may have intimidated some photographers, but I told how to do it. And I also, I had to pioneer in printing to get a higher quality printing out of the normal four-color CMYK printing process.
So you're happy with these, with the result, well, these are very accurate
color.
This, I love this one. And,
oh, yeah.
And
that, I chose that for the cover.
It's the cover as well,
It looks like a human could have drawn it.
It's a Japanese painting.
Yeah, it has Japanese brush strokes. It has sunsets. It has mist. It has symbolism. That could be a uterus and a fetus. That, you know, and a birth canal. And when I made the book, really what I was thinking is that these rocks are art.
Yeah.
They're not just material for making jewelry or other kinds of art form out of. They are, and all I'm doing is framing them. And they're actually derivative art. The first art was, first of all, nature making these three-dimensional sculptures. But then somebody dug this up, and somebody cut it, and somebody polished it.
Yeah.
And I came along and photographed a portion of it and framed it.
It's
kind of like
stuff.
When I make a picture of a beautiful stand of aspen trees. I didn't grow the aspen trees, but I got myself there in good light, and I framed it. And I'm sort of doing that here.
You're bringing it to us, which is, I think, the real act of the photographer, is taking that that experience and bringing it to us.
Any artist's first job is to notice and appreciate.
Yeah, and what a great gift you give us.
You create something in an act of appreciation. I used to think that there was beauty out there, and you could catch it in a butterfly net and take it back. And it isn't that way.
No.
Beauty actually gets created in the act of appreciation.
Yeah.
Georgia O'Keeffe used to say, people look at a flower and they see it, but they don't really see it. And she said, I paint them really big, so people will stand in front of the painting, look at it for a while, and they'll take it in and they'll see it in a different way.
Yeah.
And maybe the next time they're out in the forest and they see a flower, they'll see it in a different way.
Wow.
And so I feel like with the rock photos, I'm doing the same kind of thing. I'm making these big prints that lose their sense of scale. It's different than handing you a polished rock.
Mm-hmm.
It's I'm giving you a
you see it
print.
Differently. You absolutely
and
do.
Yeah. People, I'm basically saying, hey, look at this.
Well, Lisa's going to love this. I'm going to love it, too. Thank
I used
so
to print
much.
With, with using modern pigment inkjet printers.
Yeah.
I used to print on photo paper and matte and frame them. And what I found is there's a lot of glare involved. And it's in a lot of people's living rooms, you can't see the thing.
Yeah.
So I started switching to using
I love these canvases. Okay, John,
somebody
could you
hand me
the
I want to show first the... Well, I had both of them so I can just reveal the other. Okay.
So this is the first way you used to do it, which is matted and printed on photographic paper.
And this is
paper.
Kind
it's
of
still beautiful.
A,
I mean, there's nothing.
A typical,
lift it up a
traditional
little
way of presenting a photograph.
Right.
With a mat and a frame and some plexiglass or glass. And the problem is there's a lot of glare and it's sort of hard to see.
Right.
And what I've found is that by going to a canvas print instead, this is exactly the same space on the wall.
And we
but
have
got
a lot
of lights more
in
image.
Here. Yeah, no kidding.
And you can touch it. There's nothing between you and it. It's got a coating on it so that I can wipe it off if it gets dusty. But in order to do this, I had to do a lot of learning about canvas printing.
What kind of printer do you use?
I just switched from a Epson 11880 professional wide format printer to a Canon 9400.
Mm-hmm.
They're both really good printers. Mm-hmm. I just switched to the Canon because...
And so they sell the canvas paper.
So this is a specific canvas that's been coated with a microporous ceramic surface that will retain the color, keep it from bleeding, and keep it to the surface where it'll do some good.
Okay.
So I use Breathing Color Live canvas, and I've tried 25 different canvases and found which ones work better.
Yeah.
And you have to coat it. This has got the Breathing Color timeless.
Show us the video, because Bill, of course, had to build a coating machine.
Yeah, and I do it all at home. I print it at home.
These are beautiful.
I build the stretcher bars myself at home. I stretch it myself.
Wow, you stretch it yourself? Wow.
I made tools. This is the thing. You want to do art really well, you've got to make tools.
Yeah.
Use engineering to support art.
Yeah.
So I made the traditional tool for stretching a canvas is like a 3-inch pliers.
Right.
And you stretch, you staple down one side.
Right.
You stretch the other,
right.
And you got this band of tight.
Yeah.
And it's and then you have to kind of go around and around. And it usually ends up lumpy.
Yeah.
And not centered either.
Right.
Because
it's stretched in different ways.
Well, you staple one side before you stretch the other.
Right.
So what I've done is I've made 4-foot and 6-foot gripper bars. That are aluminum bars that have that are hinged, that have 3M Safety Walk stair tread tape on the inside. And they grab the whole edge. It's a 4-foot canvas pliers.
And then you crank it?
Put it over the top and the other one over, and you join them with a ratcheting tie-down strap and crank it up
crank
to 300-400 pounds of force. And it's completely stretched before you put
it's
the first staple
stretched.
In.
It's before perfect. It's perfect. It's like a drum.
And this one, let me see. This one was printed in... 2015. It's not that old.
It's only a year old.
I have ones that are
10
years
well.
Old that are still drum tight.
Well, and these are the prints he sells for $1,200 on his website. You should definitely check these out. I'm going to get one for Lisa because, don't tell her. But I might get that black
Don't
oval.
Tell her. She's
black,
listening to this.
Do you have a... She will, unfortunately.
I've got all of them.
She loves the opal.
So,
And in order to coat
in
it...
Order, what I've been doing... Yeah.
You built this coating
To coat
machine.
It, I used to have a vertical easel.
Yeah,
7-foot
kind of
tall
it.
By 8-foot wide, and it's tilted out from the wall.
Yeah.
And you have to pin the print up on there. And so you've printed it on the inkjet printer. It's already printed,
right.
But it's very fragile, and
right.
The blacks aren't black, and the colors aren't saturated because you haven't coated it yet. When you coat it, you used to use a high-volume, low-pressure spray gun, and you have to kind of go back and forth. Mm. And you're trying to keep the same distance away from the print.
Yeah.
As you walk back and forth. And you're trying to overlap the same amount each time.
Right.
You're trying to walk at the same speed. And if you don't do all of those, it comes out a little lumpy.
Like sure. It's uneven.
More spray here and less there. And also because you're vertical, it may dribble.
Right.
And you start all over from scratch. When that happens, you have to make a new print.
You do. You can't
and
just
so
wipe it off.
What I've done is to make what I call a spray bot, to make higher quality coating. More even, I spray straight down. I made a table and a robotic arm that sprays the coat in just 3-inch swaths with a 6-inch spray.
You have a video of it, I think, on your iPad.
Yeah, let's see.
By the way, you like the iPad Pro.
I love the iPad Pro.
Yeah.
It doesn't go in my glove compartment like my.
That's
my
where I got
iPad
the little. I ended up getting the little one because I like the.
Having a real keyboard is worth a lot to me.
Yeah.
This is my spray bot. Tools for doing art with.
Look at that. You like doing this stuff? You like building things as well as doing the art? Make the tools.
I like the results.
Not so much making the. Tool.
Well. I like the challenge, but I actually like the results.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't make tools just for the fun of making tools. I make tools because I have something I want to do.
Right.
And this one is helping me make a very even coating over this print. Oh, look, it's the same one that we're looking at there.
Look at that.
And so the silvery things are dryer vent coating to keep the spray from... gunking up the linear bearings on
the
tracks.
Oh, of course, yeah.
It's all made with T-slot aluminum, which is erector set for big boys. Really, you can make something quickly with it.
Have fun.
I love T-slot aluminum. And I made a stepper motor controller for it. It's driven from a Mac. I got my little gold... MacBook.
Aren't those great? I love those little MacBooks.
And it's driven by Apple scripts.
Yeah.
And see how even a coating
perfect.
You get off of it.
Well, and we can see it here. It's gorgeous.
Oh, This has been so great talking to Bill. We're almost done. Our last segment still to come. Before we go on, though, I want to remind you about Epson. Epson is reinventing the printer. They continue to do this, starting with my very first Epson dot matrix printer. I remember the MX80 and then the FX80. That was decades ago. Today, of course, Epson makes great lasers and inkjet printers. In fact, I've always had an Epson printer for photo printing, for day-to-day printing. There's nothing better. When they came out with their Precision Core technology, I just was thrilled. This is the print engine from their high-end printers, the industrial, the professional printers. 40 million drops of ink a second. So that means you're getting really crisp black and white text, vivid colors, all the benefits of an inkjet printer, like no warm-up time, automatic two-sided printing. It's a scanner, it's a faxer, it's a copier. It does all of that. It's an all-in-one printer. But now they've made it even better. I just love this because, you know, what was the one negative? Well, you run out of ink in the middle of a print job. You got to go out and get more cartridges. This solves this problem. Epson now has on their EcoTank printers, and by the way, that's an apt name because there's a lot less waste in the landfill. It's got a tank on the side. And when you buy the printer, it comes with ink bottles, or the big printers that come with ink packs, with 2 years of ink. It's in the box. So you take the, and I just did this because Lisa bought one for our house. You open the bottles, you put it in. Now that tank has enough ink. It depends on the printer you get, but for the printer, we got the ET4550. It has enough ink for 11,000 black and white pages. 11,000, 50 ink cartridges worth. 2 years worth of ink in the box. So I am now set. I'm not going to have to worry about this for a couple of years. And you still get the Precision Core technology. You get their great ink, their great color, vivid text, beautiful colors. No wonder the ET4550 was named a CES 2016 Innovation Award honoree. The new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer. It doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features the innovative, reliable ink tank. They call it the EcoTank. Now you have freedom to print without running out of ink. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to transform the way your home, your office, your work group prints for the best combination of ease and value. Turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers, EPSON.com/EcoTank, and we thank Epson for their support of Triangulation. Epson, exceed your vision. I almost don't want it to end. Our final words with Bill Atkinson as we continue. But just a tip, a little reminder, Bill's coming back, and we're going to record a special, it's not even a Triangulation, a special episode about his photo card app. Bill wanted somebody to show, you know, he wanted a video to give to photo card users so they could understand the kind of the deeper features of it. So I said, let me do it, Bill. I love photo card. I'll do it with you. So we're going to record a special hour-long special. Look for it on our Twit specials feed, twit.tv/specials. And how to use photo cards, just the ins and outs. So we're not even done. More Bill Atkinson to come on the Twit Network. But here, we'll continue the interview we recorded about 2 weeks ago with Bill Atkinson. Enjoy.
So you also still write software.
Yes.
And
actually, the passion of my life these days is printing postcards for people. So I'm trying to rescue the postcard tradition, the old-fashioned tradition of printed postcards. Some people say, well, we have to let go of that to get with the modern mobile
right.
computing paradigm.
Right.
And I think you can do better than that, which is use mobile computing to reinvigorate an old tradition. So
I
want to make
really
it
neat.
Much easier and much more customized to make postcards that have personal impact. And postcards that are big and beautiful. They end up on the fridge.
They really are gorgeous.
They have sort of, I think of them as a lasting presence.
Yeah.
So they're...
These are not disposable. These are not throwaways. These are...
You know, our texts and our emails are wonderful. I'm not a Luddite. But they scroll off.
Right.
They're not... The email that I got last week is not in my mind right
no.
now. But the postcard that went on the fridge last week
yeah.
is still in my mind.
Yeah.
And being able to make these. I wanted to do something really beautiful. This should be art. I'm not interested in doing something unless I can do it the best way that's possible to do.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to make these, for example, little things like the stamp on it. I didn't want to just say U.S. first class fees paid.
Right.
Because it would look like junk mail.
Right.
And so I wanted it to be able to have a beautiful stamp on it, and even a custom stamp. You can have real U.S. postage that has your photo on it.
That's the indicium. So that the post office recognizes that as postage.
Right. So I buy blocks of serial numbers. I pay up front for 49 cents a stamp.
This is really a cottage industry. I mean, you're printing these at yourself and
so
everything.
No, I don't do the printing myself. I have a printing partner in San Jose, Progressive Solutions. Really good guys to work with.
They're gorgeous. I have to say the color and everything is really nice.
And they have a giant indigo press.
Yeah.
So this, they're
nice.
$500,000 indigo press prints these. And then they're laminated. They have to be laminated on both sides. Here's like a sheet of four cards.
So that's how they come out of the...
Laminator. So they come out of the laminator like that.
Show the wide shot there. There you go. So it's like a placemat.
And then they have to be cut apart.
Yeah.
In order to get full bleed, you have to print a little big. So these are 20th of an inch big, and they trim that off that 20th of an inch. So they get printed and laminated. At first, we weren't laminating them, and we got a lot of postal damage.
Yeah.
And so we realized we had to laminate them.
You can even now wipe off the...
They're Mylar on both sides. And they're inspected, and then they're mailed.
It looks so good.
And lately what I've been doing, I made it so... See, there's the laminator. Lately, I've just set it up. They've got a new, bigger printer that can do 9-up sheets.
Oh, that's good.
And so they can do a higher volume of cards.
Now, how much is this going to cost me to print?
$1.50.
Buck and a half.
Including the 49 cent postage.
And that's actually a very
good deal.
And
there's no tax.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
So, and you download PhotoCard, and then you'll buy credits from PhotoCard, in chunks of time, like 30 credits or whatever. And
typically people buy like 30 credits for $25, and that enables them to send 15 cards to the U.S. or 10 cards international. It costs 3 credits if you're going international because I got to put a $1.20 stamp in.
And you know what's nice? These are big. They're not, they're big prints.
They're the same size as a half a sheet of letter paper.
Yeah. So it's five, what is
what
it?
The post office calls a jumbo. No, it's a 5.5 by 8.25.
5.5 by 8.25. So it's really
what the
big.
Post office calls a jumbo postcard.
That's making me hungry, that one right there. Look at that.
What I find is people send them, each morning, and several times during the day, I pulled down the orders from the server that I wrote. So I had to write the app. I had to write the App Engine server that runs on Google App Engine.
Right.
I wrote that in Python. I wrote the app in Objective-C.
Uh-huh.
And I write production code that actually pulls down these, does second-level address correction. The Intelligent Mail barcode on each one has an 11-digit zip code in it. And nobody ever gives me that. You don't know your 11-digit zip code, so I have to look that up.
Yep.
And that also gives me an opportunity to catch any wrong addresses.
Right.
The first-level address correction goes on in the app. It goes, you type in an address, it'll go out to the Internet, check the address, bring you back, and warn you if there's a mistake in it. So I get mostly correct addresses, but even then, some slip through that aren't corrected, and I'll fix them. The other thing that happens, it's mostly an automated process that would run if I weren't there, but I oversee it and I make it better. I give it the extra touch. With a card, the photo on it is too light or too dark, I put a curve on it in Photoshop and resave it. Yesterday I did one where the face was too dark, but everything else,
I had to actually do
a masked one.
Oh my God. Right?
So it's a level of
this is
care
a labor of
and,
love.
Yes, it is. And in fact, over the 7 years I've been doing it, which is longer than the total time I spent on the Mac and on HyperCard, and it's more code than all of those rolled together, maybe 10x. And the work I've done on this over the last 7 years, I've not paid myself any salary. My wife and I just do it because it should be done. We've not made money. We're hoping we can get enough people sending cards that we'll actually start making money. And the reason why that's important is I want to be able to hire an Android programmer and an HTML5 programmer so that this thing can be available to everybody. And I also want to have a tech support and production assistant.
Yeah.
Because right now I do it all myself. If somebody sends me an email, where'd my card go or how do I do this? That's me you're talking
to.
I answer
it. Wow.
There's nobody
else.
You're
a crazy man. You're dedicated, obviously.
But if I get that small team in place, then it will continue on even if I die.
Well, I'm going to start
doing
this.
I'm 65. I had my 65th birthday 2.5 weeks ago.
Happy birthday.
I'm now officially on Medicare. which is actually an important money-saving
feature.
It's
not a bad thing. Yeah.
Drugs cost a lot less when you're on Medicare. Yeah. But I look at my future, and I look at actuarial curves and things like that, and I figure I got 15, maybe 20 years of good brain time before I have to deal with major medical and maybe Alzheimer's. In that time, what I want to do is get this to grow to where a lot of people are using it and get it to be self-sustaining so it will continue on. If I die in a car crash on the way home, this is out. I do it all myself. You know, it wouldn't continue.
Everybody must go right now to download PhotoCard on their iPhone, buy 30 credits, start sending them out. I'm going to do that.
So this is, you know, something very timely is that there's a new version of it. Oh. You're looking at version 11.0.
Yeah.
Well, 12.0 was uploaded on Thursday. And what does it have that 11 doesn't have? The first thing is I've gotten the app size down from 161 megabytes to 31 megabytes.
Wow.
Now, how I did that is instead of bundling all the artwork, there are 220 stamp designs and 440 stickers and 220 nature photos. But not everybody uses all of those.
Right.
Some people don't use the nature photos
much. I'm going to use my photos,
Most cards that come through, I'd say 85% of the cards that come through use people's personal photos, not my nature photos. Yeah. So why should they be stored on their iOS device?
Right.
So what happens is there's on-demand loading now. When you choose a sticker or a nature photo, it gets downloaded and kept on your device, but only those that you've chosen get downloaded. So that saves space. Also, another thing that I did, a lot of people are using it on an iPhone, where's mine?
Uh-oh.
I had it around. Oh, here it is.
I like it on the iPad, though. I think it's nice to have
it. Oh, it's
that
best
size
on the iPad because it's big enough to see what you're doing.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
On the iPhone, a lot of people are using it and finding they're using it in portrait orientation.
Right.
It used to be you could only use it in a landscape orientation like this, where the text is big enough to see. But when you turn it like this, it's pretty hard to see this text.
Right.
So Tom Gruber suggested something that I immediately implemented, and it's in PhotoCard 12. If you touch on the text to edit it, it zooms in on just that part.
Fat bits.
Yeah, well, you want to make it so that you can easily see the text, and when you put the keyboard away, it zooms back down
to
normal.
Great.
So those features are in PhotoCard 12, and because the full version is now smaller than the light version was, we've discontinued the light version. Now you don't have to choose.
Oh, good.
See, we used to have a light version was you could download over cellular because it was under 50 megabytes. And now the whole thing is 31 megabytes.
Nice.
For the full one, you have choice.
Nice.
All of the artwork is available, but it's smaller than the old light version.
Good.
So we can let
so get the full
that
version, and it's free, and buy some credits, and let's keep this going because I love this idea.
Yeah.
I agree with you. There's something about the physicality. And the images are really nicely printed, so that really is.
Well, I am a color management expert.
He does know a few things about that. Bill, what a thrill it has been to spend. You gave us 2 hours of your time, more, and I'm so grateful to you.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
We are not going to edit a second out of this because every moment was fantastic. I'm thrilled to live in the same era as you. Thank you for being a part of our world and for all the differences you've made and all the things you've done. It's truly an honor.
Thanks. You know what I find really motivates me about the PhotoCard project?
What?
I don't make any money at it, but when I finish processing the cards in the morning and I go back upstairs and snuggle in next to my wife, I just made 300 people smile. I know it. When I'm working on the cards, I'm thinking about the person who's getting the card. And I am privileged to witness the beautiful side of humanity. You know, when you watch too much CNN, you think people are really screwed up and really damaged. But what I'm seeing here is just the opposite. Nobody sends hate mail on a postcard. Doesn't happen. Has never happened. What I see are when somebody cares enough to craft something special that's custom and send it. And what, you know, I'm sort of like, I think of life as this stream that's going by you, and you're a fisherman. You get to kind of fish things out of the stream. But you can choose what portions of the stream to divert your way. And I'm choosing to divert into my life these little packets of love that people are sending. And it renews my faith in the basic goodness of humanity. And then I don't think about the terrorists as much.
Something we
I think
need
about
right now.
The human side.
Yeah.
And so my job is to facilitate this. I shepherd these along their way. I'm sort of a digital age postal worker. There's confidentiality involved, but they are postcards that are going to be seen by every postal worker along the way, so it isn't that much confidentiality. But I feel like my real reward is that I get to a little insight into people's lives. And I see beautiful cards going by, you know, a newborn babe, a family moment. What Kodak used to sell film and cameras by called a Kodak moment? I see those every day as I'm processing the cards. And every day I think, yes, that's why I'm doing this.
Wow.
And no, I'm not a Luddite because I, you know, stick with old printed stuff. I've had 14-year-olds who said, well, why would you want printed? And then they got one in the mail. And they put it up on the wall,
yeah.
And they cherished it.
Yeah.
And I've had people write me. My grandma gets them all the time, and she loves them. Oh. And I went to visit her, and they're all in her mantelpiece.
Oh.
Or my mother is in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and she's starting to forget who we are when we visit her. So we send her a deck of cards that have our picture on the front and a little write-up about us. So before we come, she looks through her deck of cards, and she now knows who we are when we visit.
That's beautiful.
So I think there are lots of things that this can be used for. Yeah. And I would just like to see what I really need to make it work, to make it work for my printing partner. They've been kind of forward pricing, if you will. You know, nobody wants a $10 postcard.
Right.
And they're not making money either.
Right.
They would make money if there were more.
Good.
Right now, we're only printing and mailing 500 to 800 cards a week. That should be more like 10,000 a day.
I agree. Let's do it.
And most people that go to the App Store, they don't know they want to make a postcard.
No.
And so they don't find this.
Photo card.
Yeah.
Photo card. Yeah, you remember HyperCard? Now there's photo card.
Yeah.
What a pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you for inviting me.
My great pleasure.
Send some cards.
I'm going to send a lot of cards. You know, I just decided that I'll start, because, you know, I get lots of great things from people, gifts and so forth, and I, you know, mean to write thank you notes, and I never do. I'm going to start sending out photo cards. That's what I'll do. Really, this is going to be a great handy thing.
I could send you a card right now.
No, it's okay. You were here. That's better than a card.
Well, I'll still send you a card.
Okay, I'll take it. 140 Keller Street, Petaluma, 94952.
Wow, wasn't that great? Bill Atkinson, my hero, and by the way, one of the sweetest guys ever. He was so generous, and we were so grateful to have that 3 hours to talk with him. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to do a special on using photo cards, so watch for that in your Twit feed. More triangulation next week. You know what? I don't have my schedule in front of me. I'm not sure who's coming up, but you know one thing you can always be sure of? It's always going to be somebody really interesting. I feel like we're really doing some interesting stuff on triangulation. Make sure you don't miss an episode. You can watch live every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Time or 1800 UTC on twit.tv/live. But you can also get it after the fact, on-demand audio and video, always available on our website, twit.tv/TRI. You can also get it on your favorite podcast application on your phone or your desktop, iTunes, of course. And there's Twit apps for every platform, Roku, Apple TV, iOS, Android, even Windows Phone. So get the app, subscribe to the show. Do not miss an episode of Triangulation. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.